From 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. On this Memorial Day show, more than a century after the U.S. entered World War I, Doughboy MIA works to identify our remaining soldiers still missing in action.
We lost 116,000 plus in the war. Graves Registration Service handled over 80,000 burials, and they did the whole thing with paper forms and shoeboxes full of index cards. And the fact that we only have about 2,200 that are truly missing in action, I think that's a pretty good record.
Then a Milwaukee writer goes searching for the site of his dad's fatal plane crash in World War II.
And we'll visit the dedication of the new memorial to a fallen airman from Milwaukee, Captain Lance Sijon.
It's a great reminder, not only of him, the person, what he did, what he went through, justifiably awarded the Medal of Honor. And then we think about all the other people who didn't come home.
Lake Effect is next. News is first. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks so much for joining us today. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. Today is Memorial Day. For most of us in the U.S., this long weekend marks the unofficial beginning of summer, and it's also the first federal Monday holiday since February. If the weather holds, many of us are outside today enjoying barbecues with friends and family.
Memorial Day itself, however, is a solemn day. Shortly after the end of the American Civil War, a day in May was designated as Decoration Day, a day to honor and remember those who died in service to our country. Over the years, the day the holiday is observed changed to the last Monday in May, and after World War I, the day came to be known as Memorial Day. The name was officially adopted in 1967 by presidential proclamation.
On our show today, we revisit four stories of sacrifice in service to our country. We'll start with a story from World War I, which the U.S. entered 102 years ago on April 6, 1917.
Robert Laplander lives in Waterford, Wisconsin. Since the early 2000s, he's been actively working to properly identify and commemorate U.S. soldiers who are still missing in action from the First World War. His all-volunteer organization is called Doughboy MIA, and we talked with him in 2017 to learn why he started his sleuthing work.
Originally, I was writing a book on the Lost Battalion, a unit that was trapped behind enemy lines for 5 days in World War I. And word got around. I'd spent some time in France walking around the area and getting to know distances and et cetera. And word got around in France of what I was doing. And I got a lot of help. And in 2005, a friend of mine got a hold of me. He said he had been contacted by a French battlefield archaeologist who had picked a few things up at the site. And he wanted to know if I'd be interested in them. And I'm like, sure, not a problem. So he mailed them over, and one of them was a dog tag. And when we did the research on it, we found out it was a dog tag from a guy in the action who was missing in action. So we started doing the research on him, come to find out. Matter of fact, he was originally from Wisconsin. He'd been drafted out of South Dakota and killed on October 5th, 1918. When they buried the bodies in the temporary battlefield graves, he had no tags on him, but somebody must have known who he was. His name was Eugene McGrath, and they put his initials on the cross. When they transferred the bodies from the battlefield graves to the big American cemetery, the cross and the body got separated, and he's in an unknown grave over there in the American cemetery at Meuse-Argonne. The more we dug, the more research we did, the more we found and eventually came upon the American Battle Monuments Commission list that shows 4,423 that are missing in action. About half of them are missing at sea or lost at sea. So, you know, we know where they are, but they're unrecoverable, obviously. The rest of them, if we could find the proper paperwork, I know that Eugene McGrath, we could name which grave he's in. So we started to dig to find more paperwork, and it just kind of snowballed from there. And then in 2015, the U.S. World War I Centennial Commission got wind of what I was doing and asked if I would host something on their website, and that's how Doughboy MIA came about. The mission statement originally was just that we were going to take a look at all the case files for all these guys and try to make a conclusion as to what happened to them. And that has since expanded to identification when possible, and possibly even recovery and identification for those who are still missing in the wilderness of the battlefield.
And when you say we, you're talking about a group of volunteers, yourself as well as the folks who help you. This is not an organization where you're getting paid for this.
No, it's an all-volunteer organization. My wife and I run it on this end. We kind of manage the whole thing and oversee everything. When we need help with something, we put the word out and volunteers show up. We have one senior research analyst that we use down in the D.C. area when we have to get to the National Archives at College Park. She's always ready to go, her and her daughter. We have two men overseas, one in the Netherlands and one in England, that I place the emails, and they go and walk the battlefields or look at what I need looked at, take pictures, make reports. And then there's a network all across the United States, depending on where we have to go to dig, that's willing and able to show up and help. Most of the time when we hit the archives, we're looking through a lot of boxes. The last major poll that we did was at the National Archives in March of 2016, and we had a team of seven, including myself, that went through 300 boxes in 4 days. The other thing that we do is in St. Louis at the National Archives, the National Personnel Records Center, is where the burial files for all of the dead from the First World War are. So we'll go and we'll pull those. If I go down myself, I'll take my wife and maybe one or two other people. We'll, you know, shoot pictures of 200 burial case files. If I need one on the fly, we work with a private researcher who we have to pay because it's what he does, but he gives us a really nice deal, and he does very quality work. So we have a lot of people that we can depend on, but it is all funded through my own pocket pretty much, and whatever people care to kick in. The government pays nothing for it. We don't draw a dime from the U.S. World War I Centennial Commission or any corporate sponsors.
Now, the commission, I'm sure, though, is interested in the work that you're doing because it certainly would enhance what they are already doing.
Oh, yeah. The commission backs us fully. They are always on our side, and they're ready to use whatever resources they have available to get the word out. They're the ones that really help us spread the word when we need volunteers or if we're looking for one particular piece of information. For instance, right now, what we're looking for is the burial files for the unknowns that are buried overseas. We've actually been looking for those for a number of years. We've never been able to find them. They're in the archive someplace. We just don't know where. So if a listener out there happens to know, I'd sure like to know myself. So.
Okay, so these are files, they're records of burials. They just don't know who they are.
Right.
Okay. And so, and the actual files themselves, nobody knows where they are.
Right. It's 100 years. Mm-hmm. That's a lot of time for files to be moved and moved again and moved again. They closed investigations on these guys in about 1932. Between 1932 and 1934, they closed all the cases. They decided if we haven't found them or we haven't identified those remains that are unknown right now, the chances are pretty good that we're not going to be able to. So they closed the files. And our government throws nothing away. We found amazing things in the archives, things that have really advanced our knowledge in what we're doing and have helped us along. That would be a major step to find those files for the unknowns. But as such, we have not yet located them. I'm sure we will. It's just a matter of time.
I know this sounds like an obvious question, but why is it so important to you to track these men down and put a final stamp on that record?
That's the biggest question that we get. That's the one that's asked the most. And the answer is the same all the time. Why not? If we can, why wouldn't we? America traditionally brings their dead home and names them. We honor them. We do what we can. These men gave every last thing that they had. They lost their lives in the service of their country. I know it's fashionable to say they gave their life for freedom. When you really break it down, they lost their life in the service of their country. And the least that we can do is try to give them a named grave. Now, in the current case that we just sort of cracked, he was a sailor who was missing at sea, Herbert Hammond Renshaw. Was one of the very first casualties of the war. He was washed overboard from his ship on his very first cruise on May 22nd, 1917. He was the first man from Maryland who was killed. And when they're lost at sea or buried at sea, their names are carved on what are called the walls of the missing or the tablets of the missing. Each cemetery overseas has that in their chapel. Concrete walls that are covered with names of the missing in action. And we were contacted by Dr. Stephen Genrich from Salisbury University, who was doing some research on Marylanders and Baltimoreans who were killed in the war. And he noticed on the tablet that they have in Baltimore of all those from Baltimore and Maryland who gave their lives that this man's name was there, but it was not included on our Doughboy MIA list. So he questioned that, and we went to work and started to look to find out what happened. And the Navy knew about him. The War Department knew about him. Everybody knew about him. Somehow his name got missed being carved into the wall. So for 100 years, he missed being commemorated with his comrades on that wall. So we petitioned, we put together the report, petitioned the American Battle Monuments Commission. 2 days after we submitted the report on April 28th, 2017, they approved it. And later this summer, Seaman Renshaw's name will finally, after 100 years, be included on the wall to the missing at Brookwood Cemetery in England.
That must feel both really good that you were able to do that, but also bittersweet that he had 100 years of people not being able to remember him.
He was remembered. He was remembered at a county level and at a state level. He just wasn't remembered at a federal government level in the way that everyone else was. That's an injustice, and it's an omission. When you stop to think, though, that at the end of the war, the Graves Registration Service, we lost 116,000 plus in the war. Graves Registration Service handled over 80,000 burials, and they did the whole thing with paper forms and shoeboxes full of index cards. And the fact that we have so few truly missing, we only have about 2,200 that are truly missing in action. I think that's a pretty good record. I give them all the credit for that. That one name got missed, I'd like to say, oh, that's okay, guys. But you can't say that because this man, like I said, he gave everything. So now we fixed that. And now he will be remembered. And here 100 years later, we're talking about him. And at Doughboy MIA, our motto is, a man is only missing if he's forgotten. And Seaman Renshaw will not be forgotten. That is tremendously important to us. It's a victory for the family. It's a victory for us. But most of all, it's a victory for the American people.
How hopeful are you that the remaining 2,200 missing service members will be tracked down? I mean, are there going to be some that you're just not going to be able to find?
Most of them we will not be able to either locate or identify. When we look through the burial files, following the war between 1919 and, like I say, 1932, they did everything they could to identify remains and to find remains. What we have available to us now, though, as far as technology goes, is so far above everything they had. We have deep penetration metal detectors, ground penetrating radar, spatial imaging. We can do things they couldn't do. We can see into the ground. You know, they couldn't do that. For instance, we're working on one case right now that they looked for him in 1919, and then they looked for him again in 1926. And when you look at the map coordinates where they were searching, they don't match up with the action in which this man died. And they certainly don't match up with the statement made by the chaplain who buried him. So I got my grounds research people on it, and a week ago Saturday, they were in France and walking the battlefields with all the information in hand and taking a look at the topography, which has changed very little. And they believe they found the trench where this guy was buried. Now it gets a little more prickly, a little more dicey, because if we're going to launch an expedition to go over there and try to locate him, now it comes into serious money. And we have to, you know, tap the French government on the shoulder. They have a Department of Archaeology. Part of their job is to do stuff like this. And we know the guy who runs that department, so he'll back us on it, but we need the permits. And then we need to get explosive experts who come with us, because there's still a lot of unexploded ordnance over there in the battlefield. And the ABMC will have to be there. World War I Centennial Commission, of course, will be there. There's a lot of coordination that goes into it. But before that happens, we have to make sure, really sure, that we're in the right spot. Otherwise, that's a lot of money down the drain and a lot of hopes raised for nothing. We are really, really thorough in everything that we do. Most of the guys that were over there that are in unknown graves are in unknown graves because there simply was no way to identify them. Will we find a few on the battlefield? I'm sure we will. Will there be a couple of paperwork errors if we can find those missing files? I'm sure there will be more than one. We can fix some of those things. And if we could name 3, 4, 5, maybe recover a couple of sets of remains, that's a victory.
Looking forward, how long do you plan to do this work?
Well, the official mission of the World War I Centennial Commission goes through the end of 2020. So Doughboy MIA, as far as the work we do at the World War I Centennial Commission and that website, will go through the end of 2020 when everything that happened for the 100th anniversary, you know, the centenary of the war, will all get wrapped up, stored electronically, and put away for future generations to look at. Doughboy MIA, I have every confidence, will continue beyond that. Our mission, like I said, is to go through every one of the burial files and see what we can do. If we're able to accomplish that mission by the end of 2020, so much the better. If we're not, we will continue until it's done.
Well, Robert Laplander, I want to thank you so much, both for the work that you and your erstwhile team of volunteers is doing, but also for talking with us today. Wishing you a good Memorial Day.
Well, thank you for having me on and the opportunity to spread the word. And a man is only missing if he's forgotten. So this Memorial Day, take a pause and remember those men from 100 years ago.
Robert Laplander lives in Waterford, Wisconsin. He's the managing director of Doughboy MIA. You can find out more about his work and that of the World War I Centennial Organization from a link at WUWM.com.
We'll take a quick break, and then a Milwaukee writer tells the difficult story of his dad's fatal World War II plane crash and the modern-day search for it. Lake Effect returns with that in a moment on 89.7 WUWM.
We're back now with more of Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Tite.
And I'm Bonnie North. On this Memorial Day, we are revisiting some of our archived interviews on ways we honor our war dead. Before the break, we learned about an ongoing effort to identify the remains of World War I soldiers. In this segment, we fast forward to World War II.
Near the end of that war, Army Air Corps Lieutenant Lauren Hintz was based in Italy when his plane was shot down. He was considered missing in action until parts of the wreckage were found a while later, and he was declared to have been killed. But the crash site was never found until 2016.
Milwaukee writer Martin Hintz was not yet born when his father died. During the summer of 2016, a team of people helped him uncover his father's crash site in Italy. Hintz joined Lake Effect's Joy Powers in the studio then to talk about his long search.
My dad was a prolific writer, and he wrote books of poetry, and he even knew Carl Sandburg, kind of an interesting young man from the 1930s. And after he died, of course, they sent home in a trunk my dad's personal effects, his dress uniform and different things. So my mom had that up in the attic. And as a kid, I'd sometimes go upstairs and kind of open the sacred trunk and look in and kind of hold his caps and some other things and thumb through his writings. He had a lot of letters and, of course, his books of poetry and little things from his growing up years. So it was as if I kind of knew him, hadn't met him, but I knew him and finally had an opportunity to meet him this past summer, literally. It was kind of quite an emotional experience.
Before you started the excavation process and even the process of just finding that crash site in general, what did you know about the crash?
He took off April 21, 1945, several weeks before the war ended. And he was based at an Italian air base called Cesenatico. And there were records. The chaplain found a few things several months after the war. He was listed as missing in action for a time because there was so much going on in that area as the war was ending. There was, you know, rubble and debris everywhere, and people were hungry and all that. And the first graves detail was able to find some remains of my dad and a few pieces of his airplane. But they were in a hurry to move on to the next place. Everybody probably wanted to get home. The war was over, and there was just so much they had to find. They had all these service people that were missing and all this. So those remains were transferred to the American Cemetery just near Florence. There was about 4,000 service people in there who died toward the end of the war, mostly fighting in northern Italy. And then that kind of was it. That was 71 years, and all the records kind of disappeared. And, well, we didn't know where they were. And about 10 or 12 years ago, my sister took my mom down to our local library in Iowa, where we grew up, and played around on the internet. You know, it's kind of all brand new way, way back then, to see some, see if they could find some reunion information about his 79th fighter group, because at that time there were a lot of the men and women of the service were trying to get together again. And my nephew Hans also got involved and was quite interested, and they threw out some emails, queries, and nothing, 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 nothing. And a few years ago, my nephew Hans was in Alaska. He's an engineer, and he was talking with a friend, and it turned out that they wound up talking about World War II, and this gentleman's father-in-law was in the 79th Fighter Group. Oh, so was my grandfather. Next thing you know, they're talking, and this gentleman, the elderly gentleman, knew my dad. So we were able to meet and talk with him. This was about 5 or 6 years after those first queries went out online. And he talked a lot about that era and my dad and things like that. And luckily, we were able to catch him because he just died last year. So really interesting at, you know, age 90-something. And as all this was floating around, my sister and my nephew did get some messages from some Italians. Said, it's our mission. We're looking to repatriate, to find remains of American service personnel to thank them for their service. And that led to eventual discovery after searching for records, and we went to the National Archives and everywhere else to find information.
So this was an effort not only spurred by you and your family, but also by a group of Italians.
Yes, and we can't say enough for our friends, because now they are our friends overseas. And at first, you know, each side was kind of, well, who's looking for what? Like, is this real? And it certainly turned out to be, because Hans was able to go to Italy a few years ago and meet these people. They're all aviation buffs. They were flyers. And they took this as their cause. They kind of lived near Bologna. That's where, it's near where the crash site was. So they were all people who, aviation enthusiasts and parachutists, and they all just love the air. And they took this on as their cause. And for about 8 or 9 years, they crisscrossed that area trying to find the proper coordinates where my dad could have been shot down. And they were, as I mentioned, Cesenatico, the air base. They flew out. There's an Italian air base now. So they were able to track his flight path and crisscross, fine. And they never really had any exact specifics. And then working, because my nephew is an engineer, they were able to use some ground-penetrating radar. I'm not sure the exact scientific name for that. But they located a mass of metal in this one area, debris field, and that's where everybody started zeroing in on the search. And we went over there this past July wondering if what's down underneath there. There was another group of Italians who specialize in archaeology and digging up planes, kind of archaeologists of the air, if you want to call it, and they had already found a number of American and Allied flyers in different places that had been missing for 70-some years, and were able to get them back to their families in the States. And so they joined up with our other Italian friends, and so that's kind of how it all got going.
Of course, Italy is a country with roots that go way far back. We're looking at pretty recent history. So you were able to speak with people who had seen the crash or who had at least been there during World War II when all of these planes were overhead. You know, what did they say to you about their experiences?
Well, everybody had a story. That was toward the end of the war, and the German army was fleeing to the north to try to, you know, get out of the way, because since my father flew a P-47 fighter bomber, it was the biggest, a single seat, one man in the plane. And they were taking out railroads and anything that moved on the roads. There was no more Luftwaffe. The German, the skies were clear. So our allies, their job was to clear the ground as these enemy troops were fleeing north. And folks in the area remember everybody on horses, horse-drawn carts, walking, motorcycles, bicycles, all trying to get north, and they were trying to trade their uniforms for civilian clothes. And one lady who's now in her 90s remembers just a few months before their barn was bombed and a cow got killed, but a group of German officers came into their kitchen and got all soused up as they were fleeing, and they spent one night there and then took off again. And so they commandeered their kitchen, these German officers, and just ready to hightail it. And they said toward the end of the war, there were mostly young conscripts, German conscripts there, 16, 17, 18, and elderly guys. And not a lot of the old battle-hardened veterans from the Russian front, because they all had moved on. So that was my dad's job, to help clear the remains of the German army out of that area.
So what happened with the crash itself?
Well, everything is conjecture, who knows. But with these various eyewitnesses and people who kind of knew of the situation, he took off from Cesenatico like about 6:30 in the morning and arrived on. He was number 12 in a flight of 12 P-47s, and he was the last man. And by the time he came through, they were attacking a row of farmhouses, 300 to 500-year-old farmhouses. We're talking history here, and the walls are like 3 feet thick and everything. So there were some German gunners that their responsibility was to take out. And he was the last one to make a pass. And apparently the gunners had zeroed in on him by that time. And his flight mates didn't notice he was missing until they had circled around and had taken off, headed back. And people in the neighborhood remember that a group of New Zealanders had come through, wireless operators, the night before, and told them there's going to be a big raid tomorrow, so be really careful, go hide. And they got them up like early in the morning and said, they're on their way. And this family, they hid in a drainage ditch behind their house. And he remembers the flight going over and a huge explosion. And I think it was one of their relatives' homes that they were attacking. So I could tell you, this is, personal stuff. And from a distance, like a quarter mile away, they could see something had gone down and a huge explosion. So that was one eyewitness to something. So either my dad was either hit or, I don't know, the plane malfunctioned or whatever, but it was a huge explosion. And they were only 800 feet off the ground, flying about 200 miles an hour. So he burrowed right into the ground, and that's why we had to do a dig.
So you were part of the actual excavation process, right?
Well, we observed, my family and I, my sister and my three kids, and my sister's two of her sons were able to come along too, because it was pretty technical. These people had really skilled professionals, and even though they're amateur archaeologists, they knew what they were doing. As I said, they had found a number of other downed pilots, and it was also a safety factor too. We came out really early the morning of July 23, and the area was marked off where they wanted to dig, and they said, we know he's down there. And my sister and I looked at each other and said, wow, how do you know? And he said, well, we just have faith. And they went over the whole area with metal detectors. There were a couple of dozen of these people, and then they started digging. And within minutes, they started finding wreckage. And then down 20-some feet, they found the plane and his remains, his dog tags, his artifacts, flare guns, things like that. So,
how did you feel when they were pulling these things, way deep out of the ground? I mean, did it feel cathartic? Was it emotional?
Well, quite emotional, yes. The Italian were so reverent and cautious. They would put the debris in the shakers, like you've seen pictures of archaeologists working to shake down to find the most minute particles, and they found a lot of unexploded ordnance that they had to take care of. The Italian Army was there, the Italian Air Force was there, the Carabinieri, the police, several hundred people, onlookers, were watching, and we were part of that. And when they started finding my dad's remains, they had a small tent set aside that the family could kind of go quiet time. And his, as they found remains, they were placed in a metal box, and it was kind of reserved for us. And noon of that day, the local parish priest came out and blessed everybody, all the workers and the people, and that was just really quite emotional. And following that, we were led over to an open space where a group of Italian parachutists presented an American flag to my sister, and they played taps and the Star Spangled Banner, and everybody got quite sniffy, of course, you know, at that particular time. And it just went on from there, and there's more to the story as we get into it, too. And we were just so lucky to find him, and just remember all the other service personnel for all the wars.
What do you hope other people learn from your experience excavating the site and resurrecting your father's legacy?
Mm-hmm. Well, hopefully it helps people open up to the fact that you know, people sacrifice an awful lot to keep us free for our democracy and give us our place in the world, and we have a big responsibility now. That's what my dad died for, and all these other people. So we have a lot to live up to.
Well, Martin Hintz, thank you so much for joining us here in studio, and thank you so much for your father's sacrifice.
Well, I really appreciate it, and my family thanks everybody who's interested in it. And once again, there were so many people helping, not just us, and so I want to be sure that they get their credit as well.
Martin Hintz is a local historian. He journeyed to Italy in 2016 on a search for the site of his father's 1945 World War II plane crash. He spoke with Lake Effect's Joy Powers then, and you can find more information at WUWM.com.
Martin Hintz's father was one of thousands of American airmen who were killed in World War II. On this day and virtually every day, the late President George H.W. Bush thought of two other airmen who lost their lives. In fact, biographer John Meacham told me that he believes the late president's experience being shot down over the Pacific was one of the defining moments of his life.
He was in many ways a transitional political figure. Last president of the World War II generation, just as that sacrifice was turning into sentiment as opposed to a genuine appreciation of what they'd done. He was shot down on September 2nd, 1944, over Chichijima, trying to take out a radio tower. He lost two crewmates who were in the plane with him. The cockpit filled with smoke. The wings of the plane went up in flames. He finishes. He drops his payload. He goes back out. He tells his crewmates to hit the silk to bail out. Then he bails out. And if you think about it, when you bail out of an airplane, the plane doesn't stop. And so he goes out, but the tail of the plane keeps moving, and he gashes his head. So another 6 or 8 inches, and that's it. Every day, and today in Houston, he thought about Ted White and Del Delaney, who were the two men who died, whose lives were in his hands. He was 20 years old. He could not vote in 1944. And 2 months before the 1944 presidential election, he won the Distinguished Flying Cross. So it's a sign of how far we've come from that cultural experience. That was one of the many moments he cried when we did these interviews. They were often like the world's worst wasp-on-wasp therapy sessions. He would say, he'd get upset, I'd get upset, then we'd change the subject. But the second thing was the loss of their daughter Robin in 1953 to leukemia. She was 4 years old, and the Bushes had never heard the word leukemia until they heard her diagnosis. She survived about 6 months, and biographers have to ask stupid questions, so I said, well, what did that teach you? And he didn't pause. He said that life is unpredictable and fragile, unpredictable and fragile. And I think that those two experiences, before he was 35 years old, with death, drove him to his frenetic, constant pace.
John Meacham speaking with us at Boswell Book Company in 2016. Meacham is the author of Destiny and Power, The American Odyssey of George Herbert Walker Bush.
We will take one more break, and then our Memorial Day edition of the show takes one more step forward in time to the Vietnam War and the 2017 dedication of a memorial to Milwaukee's Captain Lance Cijon. Lake Effect returns right after this on Milwaukee's NPR.
More of Lake Effect Now. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich. We're revisiting some of our archived interviews for today's Memorial Day show. In 2017, Memorial Day observations started early for some in Milwaukee. That's when the official dedication of the Captain Lance P. Cijon Memorial Plaza in front of the General Mitchell International Airport took place.
Cijon was a U.S. Air Force officer and fighter pilot. During the Vietnam War, his plane crashed over Laos. He successfully ejected from the plane but sustained severe injuries. A rescue mission was unsuccessful, and Cijon survived in the jungle for 46 days before being captured on Christmas Day, 1967.
Cijon escaped but was recaptured, interrogated, and tortured in two POW camps. Today, his example is held up to all military members as that of a perfect soldier who followed the military code of conduct until his death in 1968.
In 1976, Cijon was posthumously awarded the Medal of Honor for his courage and service. And since 2017, people can visit a landmark that serves as a tribute to him. A replica Phantom jet now stands tall at the airport entrance, and Audrey Nowakowski brought us this audio postcard from the dedication ceremony.
I have been waiting to say this for a long time. Welcome to the Captain Lance P. Cijon Memorial Plaza.
That's Janine Cijon Rosina, Lance's sister, who has been tirelessly working for nearly a decade to make the Memorial Plaza a reality to honor her brother and his legacy.
A true soldier doesn't fight because he hates what's in front of him, but because he loves what is behind him. The Cijon Plaza is tangible evidence of what the power of faith and stewardship can do. A made-up mind is a powerful thing. Faith can move mountains, or an F-4C Phantom jet. Our boy Lance continues to bring us together 50 years later. And today, as we are gathered here, we gather as one. We're one today. There's a connective tissue that will keep us moving forward, and remember this moment. Thank you to all who are currently serving active duty. Thank you to all our veterans and the families that love them. Because indeed, when we raise up one, we raise them all. And for the 58,220 brave soldiers that left their lives on the battlefields of Vietnam and the prison camps of Vietnam, I say hallelujah, they're home. Thank you.
People in attendance included members of the Air Force, veterans, civilians, friends and family of Lance Cijon, and public officials such as Mayor Tom Barrett and Governor Scott Walker.
Freedom, endowed by our Creator, defined by our Constitution, but defended each and every day by the men and women who proudly wear the uniform of these United States. To every one of you who have served and those that continue to serve, we say thank you. We say thank you and thank you and thank you and thank you and thank you yet again. Today, we are honoring a true American hero, Captain Lance P. Cijon, who not was, but is, and will continue to be a great American hero. We are honoring his life and his legacy. Thank you all for joining us here today. The foundation of this great country, the freedom that we all too often take for granted, and ensuring that with a plaza and a memorial like this, that will ensure that future generations, and particularly some of the young people who are here today, will pass on to their kin and the next generation after that and the next generation after that. And so it's an honor to join with you here at this time.
What will also ensure future generations' knowledge of Lance's story is Governor Walker's proclamation, read to Janine Sijon-Rosina on stage.
I, the governor of the great state of Wisconsin, do hereby proclaim this day Captain Lance P. Sijon Day all across the state.
General Donald Dunbar of Wisconsin spoke on behalf of the families of veterans.
Usually when I speak on Memorial Day, I refer to a poem that talks about a military service for a fallen member of the armed forces. And what it talks about is how the family looks on and sees the young boy or the young girl that they grew up with and remembers that memory, so different from all of us who just remember the heroism. And I think it's so important because it's through the eyes of the family that we remember that these heroes that we rightly honor and revere, like Captain Sijon, were not shadows from a Dickens play. They were real, live American men and women who had dreams and ambitions and tremendous drive to get to where they wanted to get to. And such is the story with Captain Sijon.
Colonel Dan Yanchesky, commander of the 120th Air Refueling Wing at Mitchell Field, read a letter sent for the occasion by Senator John McCain.
Dear Sijon family, a long time ago, I lived for a time in the company of heroes, men who endured great hardships but who refused to lose faith in their God, their country, and their comrades. I am a witness to 1,000 acts of compassion, sacrifice, and endurance. But of all the men whose dignity humbles me, one name is revered among all others. I never knew Lance Sijon, but I wish I had. I wish I would have had one moment to tell him how much I admired him, how indebted I was for showing me, for showing us our duty, for showing us how to be free. I lived alone once in a room next to a man who have lived with Lance Sijon. He was gone before I heard of him, but the men who had lived with him told me his story. Interrogated repeatedly, he refused to say anything. He was savagely beaten for his silence, kicked, and struck with a bamboo club. His cellmates heard him scream profanities at his guards. And then, after hours of torture, they heard him say in a weak voice, "I'm not going to tell you anything. I can't talk to you. It's against the code." His cellmates tried to comfort him in his last hours. Working in shifts timed to the tolling of a nearby church bell, they cradled his head in their laps, talked quietly to him of his courage and faith, told him to hang on. Occasionally, he would shake off his delirium and joke with his friends about his circumstances. Finally, near the end, the guards came for him. Lance knew that they were taking him away to die. As they placed him on the stretcher, he said to his friends, "It's over. It's over." A few days later, the camp commander told Bob Craner what he knew already, that his friend was dead. And Bob, a good man and a tough resister himself, resolved to spread the legend of Lance Sijon throughout the prisons of Hanoi so that his fellow Americans could draw strength from the example of a man who would not yield his humanity, no matter how terrible the consequences. A few weeks later, when I was moved to a cell next to Bob's, he told me the story of Lance Sijon, a free man from a free country who kept his dignity to the last moment of his life. Today, the warplane of Captain Lance Sijon stands as a reminder of his dignity and sacrifice, something I hope you will carry with you when you leave here today. Keep his memory alive, confident in your faith that Almighty God blessed him and gave him the strength to prevail over his enemies. Though they took his life, they could not take his dignity. Lance Cijon prevailed. Sincerely, John McCain, United States Senator.
Colonel Lee Ellis was a friend of Lance's from the Air Force Academy and a fellow POW in Vietnam. He recalled the happy memories of their time together.
Well, we went down to Tucson and spent the fall of 1966, a couple of months down there, getting weapon systems training in this F-4. And then it was great. Oh, sunshine, that red Corvette convertible 65 over there. We had some good times there in Tucson. It was wonderful. We had some fun. It was only a six-hour day of class and so on. Then we went to George Air Force Base in the high desert of Southern California, about halfway between Los Angeles and Las Vegas. Great place to fly. We would take off in a flight of four and drop down below 500 feet and go faster than 500 miles an hour. And here we are, 23, 24 years old. I mean, we're like teenagers with a high rod. It was such a thrill, such a thrill. Focused, learning, preparing to go to war. But we had a lot of fun, a lot of fun. We were in Southern California. Los Angeles was an hour and 10 minutes away. Lots of girls out there, colonel's daughters on base. Lance and I played a lot of golf. Golf and girls was our fun of that time. There's only one problem. He's about 6'2 or 3, tall, dark, and handsome, and I'm the mutt of the crowd, the mutt and Jeff, and I'm 5'9". And somehow, I love that sound. We love that sound. Somehow, in our hustling, it was called hustling back then, going out and meeting girls, going up and introducing yourself, cold calling, so to speak. And somehow I always came out second fiddle to Lance. But I'll tell you, he was the real deal. But I want to reflect back on Lance Cijon, the person, because he is an extraordinary person. He is someone that we can look up to. He is someone that we can learn from. Not perfect, but extraordinary. You know, he was focused. He knew how to have fun. He was a great friend.
Guy Gruters was a captain in the Air Force and a prisoner of war with Lance in Hanoi.
I was shot down approximately 6 weeks after Lance. He had been shot down and was in the jungle. And in a holding camp we called a bamboo prison, Lance was brought there in very bad condition. And we then were with him for the next month or so until he died, as we were brought up to Hanoi, and then, you know, he died up there in January of 1968. He was a perfect soldier, a really perfect soldier. I'll be talking today about the American Fighting Man's Code of Conduct. He lived it perfectly. You can look it up anywhere, and you can see what he was. Okay, he was beaten to death very badly on his wounds. He was very badly wounded. And it went on for weeks, and then they finally killed him by doing that. Okay, it was, and the whole time he never complained once, and he never gave him anything but name, rank, service number, date of birth. He was a perfect soldier. Not easy to do that.
You have the perspective of someone who served, and there are a lot of non-military people here today. What do you want the message to be for them in this dedication to Lance and hearing his story?
Well, I think just a thanksgiving, just a simple prayer to God and thanksgiving for service, people that serve. It takes a nation being willing to be committed to freedom to keep it. We've got to be committed. And I've seen the horror of war. Lance was one of the worst horrors I've ever seen in my life. But he's the first one to say from heaven, where I believe he is, that you gotta keep fighting. Don't quit. You know, that's what I really believe.
Colonel Tom Moe flew with Lance in the 480th Squadron in Vietnam at Da Nang Air Base and was on the rescue mission to try and save him.
It's a great reminder, not only of him, the person, what he did, what he went through, justifiably awarded the Medal of Honor. And then we think about all the other people who didn't come home. Whenever I'm recalling those days, I think the fact I came home, I had two more children, my wife and I had two more children, and now I have six grandkids. I look at them and I think of Lance and my other friends who didn't come home. It's very, very meaningful, and for Milwaukee to do this, It's a great credit to the city and to Lance and his family.
John Hart is with Team Fast Track's professional skydiving team who participated in the dedication.
Well, Captain Guy Gruders, who actually held Captain Cy-John when he took his last breath in captivity, is a friend of mine. And he asked if I would be willing to come up, and I said, absolutely. But he really was asking if I'd come up to the event with him. And then I said, well, what if we jumped? And he goes, you do that? And I said, absolutely. So that's how we got involved. And after that, I got to meet Janine, and I said, we're going to make this thing happen. It was a hard process. It was a fight to get the jump here at this airport. But it was a beautiful day. I mean, everything held out, the weather at the last second. I think, you know, God bless us with this weather, and it was perfect. Everything went perfect.
So what does it mean for you to be part of a dedication ceremony like this for someone like Lance?
Well, as a decorated veteran that served in combat, people lose their lives, and many people forget that. It's really easy to live our lives as citizens and think Memorial Day weekend is about picnics. And for me, it's about remembering my friends. And I didn't know Lance, but he was still a veteran. He still served. And to me, it was a very emotional moment to see that honor and remember flag flying. In particular, that flag has 222 signatures of lost family members. Their families sign it, and we jump it all over the country. So today had very special meaning.
My name is Michael Sterick. I'm a retired lieutenant colonel in the 128th Air Refueling Wing.
It means a lot to us,
especially those of us that flew. How much more can you ask a man to do for his country? I mean, it's when you read the whole story, and I think it's if you're going to publish this on the radio, I think it's very important that people Google the story of Lance Cy-John and read the whole thing, because just one small ceremony cannot convey the complete story. So, and I'm proud to be a hometown neighbor of his. So,
again, Colonel Dan Yanchesky.
As a academy graduate, I'll tell you that it is a touchstone for a history and a heritage for the local community here. It's important to remember this heritage, and because it binds us all together, it connects us all. The ideas of courage and selfless sacrifice just make us a stronger country, and to remember that, to remember these men and women who made these sacrifices, it's just an incredible honor to be here today.
Audrey Nowakowski brought us some of the voices and sounds from 2017's dedication ceremony for the Captain Lance P. Cy-John Memorial Plaza at General Mitchell International Airport. You can see photos at WUWM.com. That is the Memorial Day edition of Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Tite.
And I'm Bonnie North. A reminder that the National Moment of Remembrance Resolution, passed in December 2000, asks that at 3 p.m. local time, all Americans voluntarily and informally observe in their own way a moment of remembrance and respect, pausing from whatever they're doing for a moment of silence.
Thank you so much for tuning in today, and please be with us tomorrow and every weekday morning at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
It is 11 o'clock. Fresh air is next.